1998, she won a Tony for her portrayal of Sally Bowles in a revival of Cabaret. 10 years prior to that, she starred in the film Patty Hearst, about the kidnapped newspaper heiress who claimed she was locked in a closet and brainwashed into joining a terrorist group. In the final scene, Richardson, playing Hearst, talks about the difficulty in repairing her public image.
No one wants to accept their mental state is so fragile to be turned into a totally different person. Not me. I'm too strong for that. Just don't lock me in that closet.
Richardson is survived by her mother, Vanessa Redgrave, husband Liam Neeson, and two teenaged boys. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from REI, providing outdoor adventure gear and apparel for camping, hiking, and cycling in stores and at REI.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop specializes in the sales and rental of band and orchestra instruments, digital keyboards, guitars, amps, and drums, along with a wide variety of sheet music.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with one of the country's leading experts on emotions research and nonverbal communication. His name is Paul Ekman. He started out early on in his career by studying facial expressions and asking this question: are they and the emotions behind them culture-specific or universal? And then he moved on to another kinds of question, that is this: can careful observation of people, their facial expressions, their body language, tell you whether that person is lying or telling the truth? Well, this morning we'll talk a little bit about that, perhaps talk about why people lie and maybe why some people are much better liars than others. And our guest is indeed Paul Ekman. He's someone whose work has gotten a lot of attention in popular media from time to time over the years. Just recently, in connection with a new television series that went on the air at the beginning of the year on the Fox network, Lie to Me, which was based in part on his work. Recently, one of his early books has been reissued. This, I think, is the third edition of this book with some new material. The title of the book is Telling Lies, and it's published by W.W. Norton. That's in paperback, so if you're interested in doing some reading on this subject, you can look at the book. Also, another that will be coming soon that is a paperback reissue of, I believe, also an earlier work. This book is Emotions Revealed, Recognizing Faces and Feelings to Improve Communication and Emotional Life. So both very interesting books, and you might want to take a look at them. Paul Ekman is director of the Paul Ekman Group, the author of many books. He's done a lot of speaking and interviews on his work. He makes his home in the San Francisco Bay Area. He is a professor emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco. And this morning he's joining us by telephone. So as we talk, of course, your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Ekman, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I should say, perhaps again, I don't know if you recall, but many years ago here you were visiting the campus and you were good enough to be a guest on this program. And at the time, the big story in the news was the whole business of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And I'm sure that I probably invited you to make some comment on that, and you very wisely avoided really saying anything one way or another. But I was interested that there was, in fact, a portion of the of Telling Lies, this book here, that actually touches on that particular series of events.
Yes, I was in I can't remember whether it was in the second edition or the third edition. The book is now in a fourth edition with a new chapter on it. But what I thought was interesting about Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas was the likelihood that neither one of them was telling the whole truth. That, of course, it is a natural thing for all of us to remember past events in a way that casts the most favorable light upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that certainly occurred in that instance. I believe in the book I said that if you were to force me to say one person is really lying much more than the other, I would probably say it was Thomas.
But I think that perhaps gets at the one of the questions that I'm sure that people always want to know is that why is it that some people are able to lie very convincingly? And you wonder whether, in fact, if someone is saying something that is untrue and yet with every fiber of their being they believe that, whether that will come across as true.
It certainly will. If you believe your lie, then you're telling the truth as you know it. And, of course, the more often we tell a story that is at least in part or whole untrue, the more likely it is that over time we'll come to believe it. Mm-hmm. Now, people who I call natural performers can do that instantly. So the very first time they tell it, they believe their lie as they're telling it.
Yeah.
But if you know when you're telling a lie that that's what you're doing, then we have a much better chance of being able to detect that it is a lie.
I mentioned that some of this early work that you did, and interestingly enough, not all that long ago, here on this program, we talked with one of your former students, a fellow named Decker Keltner.
Oh, yes.
And we talked a little bit about his work on emotions and yours, and about these studies that you did looking at the question of emotion and whether, as many people at the time felt, that emotions were culture-specific or whether there was something about them that was universal.
Yes, actually, what I think was the decisive... pardon me, I have a touch of laryngitis, so occasionally I'll take a sip of water. The decisive study was about 40 years ago when I went into the highlands of New Guinea to study a people who had never had outside contact, who had never seen photographs, magazines, television or film. They were still a Stone Age culture using stone implements. And what I was able to find out in two trips there was that their expressions of emotion on the face were really the same as you'd see anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And their gestures, however, things like A-OK, that's a totally culture-specific body language.
Yeah, you did this very interesting thing where you got you had actors and you said to them, show me with your face, put on your face the expression of sadness or happiness or anger. And the kind of thing where you could take that picture and you would think you could show it to anyone. You could even show it to a child. And you could say to them, what's this person feeling? And they would be able to, just by looking at their face, say, oh, yes, this person is very sad or this person is very happy. Something really wonderful has just happened. And what you could do is you could then take the same pictures and show them to these people and essentially ask them the same question. Say, okay, what's going on with this person? And they essentially will tell you a story that says very clearly, yes, they recognize what a happy person looks like and what an angry person looks like and what a really sad person looks like. And they recognize that face, you know, if you bit into something that was just the most awful thing you ever tasted in your life, that face, apparently everybody knows what that is.
You're absolutely right. And clearly you've read my work because you're describing it very accurately. In New Guinea, I did the same thing. I not only showed them pictures, but I asked them to stand in front of a camera. Of course, they didn't know what a camera was. I asked them, show me what your face would look like if you just learned your child had died. Or show me what your face would look like if you were about to fight. And then I took the films that I had made there and showed them to people in this country. And you didn't need a Berlitz book. It was very clear what emotion was being depicted.
Right. So what was it that started you interested in the whole business of deceit and detecting deceit?
Well, it really wasn't my idea. It was a question asked to me by the young psychiatrist that I was teaching, who had to make the decision every week whether to keep a patient in the hospital or give them a weekend pass with their family. And sometimes patients who had been admitted because of very serious suicidal attempts, when they said, "I'm feeling much, much better, no longer thinking of suicide," sometimes the moment you gave them a pass, they took their life, and it was clear they had been lying to get free of the hospital's supervision. So the question they asked me is, how can we tell? It took me about 25 years to get an answer.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that I'm sure that we'll get into, but what you discovered that is that based on careful observation, and it's something you actually developed some training materials, people can actually study this, you can see very, very, very brief, fleeting expressions, things you call micro expressions, tiny movements of the muscles in the face, along with maybe other things like posture, body language, and so forth, that are there that can be read if you know what to look for and you watch carefully, things that will say in most cases that will tell you, is this person telling me the truth or not?
Well, it will certainly allow you to do a lot better than you would do if you hadn't learned how to see and hear those clues to deceit. But it's not perfect. We don't have Pinocchio's nose,
yeah.
So it's an imperfect science that's certainly better than chance, but it's not like being able to say, you know, that's a baby, and that's a child, and that's an adult. You don't make mistakes on that judgment.
Yeah. You, interestingly, in the course of your work, one of the things that you did was you looked at people who, in their work, had to, at least you would hope that they would have the ability to tell if someone was telling the truth or not, attorneys, judges, psychiatrists, police officers, and no doubt many of these people thought they were very good at detecting deceit. And when you actually tested them, you found what?
They're close to chance. That we tested almost 15,000 people from all walks of life, and especially people in law enforcement or the judiciary, people who make their living in part by being able to discern truthfulness. And we found that most of them are really not very good at it. Now, they can learn to become better, but it takes specific training to do that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Ekman. He's director of the Paul Ekman Group, has done a great deal of writing about emotions and nonverbal communication, nonverbal behaviors. He's the author of many books. He has done a lot of speaking, a lot of interviewing. He's an emeritus professor at the University of California at San Francisco. If you're interested in reading this work, you might take a look at his book, Telling Lies, which is now, I think you said, is this the fourth?
That's right.
Edition. The fourth edition of this book was first published in about 1985, I think. And the new edition is available in paperback. It's published by W.W. Norton and has some very interesting things. So if you're interested in getting a handle on this subject, that is the book that you can look for. You also might look at some of his others. And here, questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller. Someone from listening over in Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll-free line, so we'll go there. Hello.
Hi. Dr. Ekman, you mentioned that some people can believe a lie the first time they tell it, and then I think you also said that when people tell the same lie repeatedly, they come to believe that lie. Is that right?
Well, there's much greater chance that they will.
I see.
And, of course, individuals differ. Some people will always know they're lying.
Uh-huh.
But some people, you know, when you tell that story about the 19-inch trout you caught, you eventually come to believe it. You forget that you made it up in the first place or exaggerated in the first place.
Well, now, it seems to me that people who believe a lie the first time they tell it are psychotic. I mean, they have a false view of reality that they apparently can't tell reality from non-reality. That's psychosis, isn't it?
Well, they have a natural acting ability.
Oh, okay.
And they know immediately afterwards that what they just said was not the truth.
Oh.
But while they're telling it, they get so totally engaged in what they're saying that they actually believe it. Just as an actor, a good actor, there's not any part of that actor's mind that is reflecting on the fact that I'm playing a role that isn't me. You can't act and do that. So these people are natural actors without training.
I see. Well, now if some person couldn't get off stage, if he kept telling the same lie, thinking it was true, he would be psychotic, wouldn't he?
Well, no, he just engaged in a bit of self-deception.
Yeah.
All of us do that occasionally.
How about these people who you say, if they lie repeatedly, then they gradually develop the idea that what they're saying is true?
I'll tell you a funny story about that. When Mussolini first took office as the dictator of Italy, he wanted to impress the Italian people with what a great military leader he was. And so he announced that he had doubled the number of military divisions, not telling them that what he had actually done was cut in half the number of men required for it to be called a military division. A few years later, when he went to war, he forgot he had cut it in half, and he didn't send enough divisions into battle. So he became the victim of his own lie.
Yes, and you know, sometimes people do that, don't they? Lying seems to contain its own penalty in that sense.
That's right, and it is. There are many costs to lying. One of them is that you'll lose your own knowledge of what's true and what's false, and that can do you quite a bit of damage, as it did for Mussolini.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. And others are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think the essential point here, why it is that you can, if you know what to look for, often you can detect whether a person is lying or not, is that actually lying for most people is stressful. It makes them uncomfortable. It makes them nervous because maybe they're afraid they'll be discovered. Maybe they feel guilty about it. Interestingly enough, for some people, lying actually gives them a kind of an emotional charge because if they think they're putting something over on somebody else, that's kind of fun. And it is this, and also if you're making up your lie on the spot, that's one of those things that why it is maybe people look uncomfortable is because they've been sort of caught and they have to come up with something right away. And then the more you tell the story, then the more comfortable you get with the story that you've made. So all of this has to do really with the fact that probably for most people, lying, telling a lie, is actually kind of uncomfortable.
That's very true. And most people don't anticipate ahead of time how difficult it's going to be to maintain a lie, to remember what they've said before. And now you only can catch lies where the stakes are very high, where the reward you might get or the punishment you might receive if you're caught is significant. The lies of everyday life, where nothing much matters one way or the other, those are not detectable because, as you were just saying, there's no emotional load. If the stakes aren't high, you're not aroused emotionally, and those emotions won't leak out and betray the lie, and they won't impose any burden on your thought processes, which will cause you, even in your words themselves, to make mistakes that can betray the lie.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that there are at least two kinds of clues to deceit. One is the thing that we've just touched on, that is what you call leakage. And those little signs of emotional stress that people display perhaps without knowing them. The other is something that you call a deception clue. What exactly is the difference between leakage and deception clues?
Well, in practice, it's not a terribly useful distinction. But theoretically, if I pick up a deception clue, I know that you're probably not telling me the truth, but I don't know what the truth is. If I pick up leakage, the true information is actually leaked out. So that's the difference. In leakage, we actually can tell what it is the person's trying to conceal. With a deception clue, all we know is we're not getting a true account, but we don't know what the truth is.
So a deception clue could be something, if a person just seems very uncomfortable, they're fidgeting, they're perspiring, their eyes are looking all around, maybe they won't look at you directly, all those sorts of, they're squirming, those things would be deception clues?
Yes, they would. Now, we have to recognize, of course, that if you're under suspicion for some offense that you did not commit, you maybe show all those signs of discomfort because you're afraid of being misjudged as having engaged in some offense. And that's the tricky part. That's why I call all of these signs hotspots. They tell us something's going on. We're not getting a full account. We have to try to find out why. But very often people who are under suspicion of a serious crime, who are innocent, will look very uncomfortable because they're very worried about the fact that they're being suspected of something they know they didn't do.
And I suppose also there is the possibility of making a mistake here, getting a false positive, perhaps from someone who just, maybe they just have a nervous tick, or there is something...
Well, that's very true, and that's why I emphasize that you need a baseline. You need to know what that person's behavior is usually like. Are they someone who fidgets all the time? Are they someone who's hesitant in their speech all the time? In which case, you have to discard those signs. So it's very hazardous to make a judgment without a baseline, without some prior knowledge of what that person is like when they're not under pressure.
Mm-hmm. You know, you have a section in the book where you discuss the polygraph. This is the device that people think of as, you know, the thing that we commonly refer to as a lie detector. Not necessarily, I think, wanting to weigh in on the question, do they work or do they not? Should we use them or should they not? Should we not? But to talk a little bit about perhaps the limitations of this device, what do you think about the usefulness of the polygraph?
Well, it depends on the application or setting. There is reason to believe that in a criminal context where the police have more than one suspect and they're trying to figure out which person they should invest investigative time in, if they give a polygraph to two or three people, one of them fails and two pass, it would make sense to start with a guy who failed. In a national security context, where you're trying to detect spies or terrorists, there is no evidence that it has any usefulness at all. I was one of the authors of a National Academy of Science report a few years ago that said that in terms of national security, there's no validity for the use of the polygraph. It used to be that the biggest user of the polygraph was McDonald's, and they used it as a pre-employment screen. That is now illegal. You cannot use it in pre-employment in any job other than national defense. Now, I think it's a mistake to use it there also, because so it may deter some people. The enemies of this country have in the past, and I'm sure they're doing it now in the present, trained people on how to beat the polygraph. So it's really not of much use for espionage or terrorism, but it does have a limited but useful purpose in the initial stages of a criminal investigation.
Yeah. I guess I would think if what you're doing here with the polygraph is measuring signs of stress, and you have one of these kinds of people that for whatever reason is actually really comfortable with deception and is good at it, the kind of person you would think would be a good liar, you would think that also that person would be able to beat the polygraph.
I think you're absolutely right. The polygraph does not measure lies. It measures emotional arousal. Hmm. If you're not emotionally aroused, then it's not going to show. Another, what they're trying to do is to see whether you're more emotionally aroused when asked about a crime than when asked about other sensitive issues. But it doesn't. It makes mistakes, but it does have some use in a criminal investigation.
We have some other callers. Let us talk with them. There, we have two. They're both in Champaign, so we will start with line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm interested in this issue of law enforcement on some level because I was just wondering, I know you mentioned something about studying this overseas as well, and I study East Asia, and I was curious about the cultural relativity of the cultural assumptions we have about honesty, because in Japan, for example, lack of eye contact is simply a normal circumstance of everyday life, and no one assumes anything about someone. In fact, the majority of the populace will often avoid eye contact with many of the people with which they interact, and not simply avoid, they just will not look them in the eye. And no one assumes anything of that. And when actually, you know, one would think in an immigrant country like ours that you could have people who, you know, their own cultural assumptions. You do not assume that, you know, you're lying because you don't look someone in the eye. And I can tell you, in my own case, I was in Japan for a number of years, and I came back. I was finishing my dissertation, and I was with my advisor, and I'd been living literally with Japanese people the whole time, and I wasn't looking him in the eye. And he said, "You've got to stop that," because I was on the job market and so on. And so I certainly didn't think, you know, that I was being dishonest about anything, but I'd been in Japan so long that I had started to do that too. And I'm just wondering how that might affect how one measures, you know, on the more subtle level of, you know, in the case of law enforcement or, you know, evaluating this more generally.
Well, you're absolutely right. I did research in Japan as well on many aspects of behavior, and gaze is clearly one of the most prominent ones, where you'll find very different rules are followed in some Asian countries than in some Western countries. And that is so not just for immigrant Japanese, but for second generation and even third generation, They still will follow that practice because that's how they were brought up. Uh-huh. And it's one of the things that I teach policemen, and that is if you're dealing with an Asian, Don't jump to the conclusion that because they're looking away, they're lying. They're probably being politely deferential. So the only thing that's really universal are the facial expressions of emotion themselves, Not what the eyes are looking at, Not the gestures, not the posture, not some of the speech habits. All of those vary, and we are at a real disadvantage in a country like ours, where our law enforcement and our anti-terror people are dealing with travelers from all over, immigrants from all over, and yet all they really know is the American system, and they're going to make mistakes on everything else other than the facial expression.
Yeah, and one other thing I just noted that I used to work with a fellow who is a Hmong, from the Hmong people, and he'd been a pilot in the Vietnam War, and he would tell me these stories about seeing spirits and so on, and he literally believed this. He said he saw them himself and so on. And I really wondered, in terms of cultural relativity, this how one understands what has happened to oneself, and how stories might be related also to, you know, we might say that's a lie, but you know, how does one evaluate, you know, if people actually as a community believe that they've seen spirits and they have experienced, well, these were
right,
really
that's
unbelievable.
That's where getting into the whole issue, even of how cultural beliefs become basically part of your mental framework. So you don't really know that you're following a cultural construct. It's how you think. Even the very words we have, pardon me, in English, we don't have a word, a single word, for enjoying the suffering of our enemy.
Ah,
the Germans have such a
Schadenfreude,
word.
Schadenfreude, yeah.
Right. That doesn't mean we don't feel it, but it does mean that we don't really have an easy way of thinking about it because we have no label for it. It's not recognized conceptually in our culture as it is in Germany. So the moment you start to cross cultures, you have a very difficult time being able to interpret anything other than the single emotion signals in the face.
Well, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have another caller. We'll get to in just a moment. We're a little bit past our midpoint here, and I do want to introduce again our guest, Paul Ekman. He is emeritus professor at the University of California, San Francisco, one of the country's, maybe one of the world's, leading experts on emotions research and nonverbal communication, has done work on facial expressions and the expression of emotions, and also moved on to other kinds of questions, taking a look at people's body language and their facial expressions and what they can tell you about that person, what that person is experiencing. And sort of a major focus of his work has been deceit, detecting deceit. He's written a lot about this. And just as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, from time to time, he and his work have certainly been in the popular media. But there was a little burst of interest and attention based on a new television program, a series called Lie to Me, which is on Fox, that is in part inspired by his work. And I think also he's been working as a kind of a consultant to the series. If you're interested in this whole subject, you can look for his book, Telling Lies, Clues to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics, and Marriage. It's the fourth edition of the book. It was first published in 1985. It's available on paperback, published by W.W. Norton. Also, by the way, if you're interested in this subject of emotions, another book that will be coming out, I think, very soon here, also in paperback. This is the book Emotions Revealed. It's the second edition. The subtitle is Recognizing Faces and Feelings to Improve Communication and Emotional Life. So both of those books, very interesting. You might want to take a look at them. And questions are welcome here. We have someone else, a couple of other people we want to get to, and we'll do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign, and line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. What would be the estimate in, let's say, even the population of the United States could actually not be detected?
Well, of course, we don't have a very large sample, just about 500 or 600 people that we've studied pretty exhaustively. About 5% of them are undetectable from demeanor.
And
now, there are many other sources. I mean, most people, lies get caught not by their demeanor, not by their behavior, but by some kind of physical evidence or a witness who sees them doing something that they deny doing. But in terms of demeanor, about 5% is what we have found that we cannot catch.
Also, your research was based on Darwin. Was that correct or not?
That's right, and this is Darwin's birthday, the 200th anniversary of his birth.
I'm just absolutely amazed that, you know, years and years later, how much, you know, of his research that he did has been verified. It was just actually amazing. So, anyway, wonderful program.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, that's
it. Can I just mention something about Darwin?
Yes, please.
Darwin wrote a book entitled The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. And in 1998, I edited a new edition of that book, published by Oxford University Press in this country. And it contains in it a long introduction and a long essay afterwards. And then I put in Darwin's book itself 116 common comments by modern scientists, myself and others, that show where Darwin was on the money and the few places where he got it wrong. So it's a very well-written, very interesting book. If you're interested in the topic of emotion, it's certainly worth reading.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Effingham, and this would be line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I ask, when this sort of program comes along, I always ask the same question. I hope you'll bear with me. But has your guest ever read or heard of Wilhelm Reich?
Oh, sure. I studied Reich when I was a student more than 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think I, at that time, read everything he had written. He was a major innovator. Parts of his ideas, when they evolved into something called the Oregon Box, were discarded. But a large part of Reich's earlier writings on character and character armor really have been incorporated into many contemporary theories of psychotherapy.
Yes, and the thing that has struck me most with his writing is the his research and others into maternalism. And in my opinion, I think all of the problems we are encountered with today are the result of male-dominated society. Would you have any comment about that?
Well, I was going to say you're out of my pay level. You're really out of my territory. I couldn't comment on that more with any degree of expertise, because that's really not what I've worked on. But I do believe that we are shifting into a more equalitarian society between males and females, and I certainly hope that's the case, and I think there are changes in that direction.
Well, it appears to me that in this society, and with what you just said, that the maternal part of females then is negated, and then they adopt onto male methodology and their insistence upon absolute power. And therein, I think, is where we begin to go wrong. And then here come the society as we know it today, and the dialectic of male dominance continues downhill.
Well, I think you're right when that occurs, and I think that does occur sometimes. My wife uses a different name, Mary Ann Mason, has a book called The Equality Trap, where she argued strongly that we need different and equal roles for women, but they're different roles because women really are the human beings who bear children and have special opportunities and obligations. And in that sense, to treat them as if they're men is to ignore their reproductive function, which, if ignored, will destroy the society. So you might take a look at her book, The Equality Trap. I think you'd find much in it that you would like.
All right. Let us continue. We have about 10 minutes left, by the way, in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Paul Ekman. He's in Meredith.
Can I make two comments?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
One is that I work pretty hard on this television series, Lie to Me, that's on Fox these days every Wednesday night. And I write a commentary that appears on FoxTV.com called The Truth About Lie to Me, in which I separate the science from the fiction in that show. Most of it is based on science, most of that science being my own work. But occasionally they get things wrong, deliberately or by mistake. So you can read that blog every week. And if you go to my website, www.paulekman.com, you can also subscribe to a free newsletter called Reading Between the Lies. and every 2 weeks you'll get a discussion of another issue involved in truthfulness and lying.
All right, very good. Well, why don't we talk with someone else? And the next person in line is in Urbana, and line one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Interesting subject. I was in advertising, or I still do advertising, which is kind of an acceptable form of lies, and because it's actually it's a construct. But I found this real interesting because I've been writing off on the side. I write fiction, which, of course, is a construct. It's a falsehood. It's not. It's like a television show you watch, like a sitcom or something. You're watching a construction by people who are trying to get a message across, a joke or whatever. But I find it real interesting. You're talking about how people are how they behave when they supposedly lie, or when they're, you know, depending on the circumstance. If you're in, you know, if you're interviewed by police officers, you're probably going to be real nervous, so you would probably act differently than you would if you were with a group of friends, sort of extending the truth, to use that term. But I'm interested in the fact that I wrote a story that deals with this subject. One of the lines in the story is one of the characters was a writer of fiction. And that one of the characters asked him, well, why do you do it? And he said, because the truth is so boring. So if you remove humanity from the equation, you think of the planet as just like back in the time of the dinosaurs, but the only fiction would be camouflage. The animals would basically hide from their enemies. But isn't this whole, we're looking for an objective truth in our lives, I assume, and we followed it along, if you count the history of humanity. I mean, I have a doctorate in art history, so I followed the historical trends of humanity. And you look at how people think, truth shifts as much as the fictions. I mean, religions are basically thought of by a lot of people as pure, unadulterated fictions. So you look at science, and then you look at physics. Physics changes after Einstein, then it changed after quantum mechanics. It keeps shifting. We're looking for this objective truth, which is the, you know, like the absolute of what is outside of us. Can you comment on that?
Well, a couple of things. First, I don't consider advertising a lie because nobody expects advertising to be truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're notified ahead of time, just like when you go to the movies or the theater.
But it is a lie. I mean, your expectation is
that the actor is a liar because you're notified ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike an imposter. Now, an imposter is a liar mm-hmm. because he doesn't tell you that he's playing the role.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we all. Advertising is like bargaining. You don't expect in bargaining or in poker that people are going to be truthful to you.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we read fiction, mm-hmm. and it's entertaining if it's a good story. And if it has nothing to do with the world,
mm-hmm.
It's an open question whether it will grab us as much
so,
as
what
if
do people,
it seems
what?
To have some, even science mm-hmm. fiction, which is placed in a different time with different things happening,
mm-hmm.
still has things that we recognize as being relevant to our lives, and that's part of the reason why it's entertaining.
Okay, so you look at science, and you think science is the truth, right? Because it is objective, supposedly. I mean, for instance, the physical process is independent of us. The sun's fusion power is independent of us knowing about it, right? So it's not, you know, not observer contingent universe.
Right.
Yeah. So we assume that's true. I mean, there are stars all over the universe right now. We assume the universe is X size. So how can we, I mean, people will read the Bible, you know, the Bible or the Quran and just believe everything in it. Yet in reality, think about it. I mean, what I'm trying to say is so you know it's a fiction. So you accept the fiction. I understand that. But it's just real interesting to me how this keeps shifting. I mean, the truth shifts as much as the fictions.
Well, I wouldn't really agree with that because it is the outer edges. It is the frontiers that are changing. But there's been no change in the belief that the sun does not revolve around the earth, that the earth is not flat, it's round. I mean, there are certain things that have been established in the last 500 years that are not changing at all. It is what you're talking about is the new frontiers in science, which are always producing new knowledge, new information. Some of the facts never change. The explanation, as we get more facts, more observations, more tools of inquiry, then the explanations of those facts may change. But I don't expect to ever, for human beings to ever come back to believing that the sun is revolving around the earth.
I want to thank the caller and try to get in at least one or two more in the time we have that's kind of short. But just to put in a quick question here, which is, well, a little different and yet related, I think one of the questions that you discuss in the book is why it is often we fail to spot deception in other people. And your suggestion is that in some cases it is because we would prefer the lie to the truth.
Yes, and it's complex. I mean, do you want to find out that the person you hired is embezzling from the company? Do you want to find out that your spouse is cheating on you? Do you want to find out that your kids are using hard drugs? Well, the answer to all of those questions is yes and no. Yes, in the long run, it's better off if I know. But in the short run, those are terrible things to learn. And we unwittingly collude in overlooking the signs of lying. And that's why it's such a commonplace that the last person to know they're being cheated is the very person who is being cheated. All the friends have already figured it out. But there are very unpleasant truths that we don't want to face. I think we're seeing that right now in the economic crisis that we're dealing with, where there were signs of this much earlier that were ignored in part because facing the disaster that was on its way was a frightening thing. And so without consciously thinking about it, we overlook the signs of deception or the truth, the unpleasant truths that might be revealed.
All right, let's talk with some other folks. Vermilion County, I believe, is next. Line four. Hello.
Hi. I guess what I'm going to ask is sort of related to what you just said, but why is it that there is not much comment from people in your field about things that our politicians have been telling us? For example, every time someone talked about the Gulf War or relating 9/11 to Iraq, things like that, why is it that nothing's been said?
Well, my own research and expertise was paid for by the taxpayer. The National Institute of Mental Health supported me for 41 years. And so I have felt that if I ever get asked by Congress, I'll give an answer on anything that I might have expertise on. But while someone is in office or running for office, I will not speak out about them because there's no way to do that without having a partisan use. And I feel that's an unfair use of really an expertise that was publicly supported. Once someone is out of office, I'm perfectly free and do talk about and use them in teaching cases. But what I'm observing in Obama and in the Republican leadership right now, I will not talk about until they're out of office. I can see the downside that you're mentioning, and that is that we're not educating the public about what's happening right now. But there's no way to do that without a substantial portion of the country thinking that guy is a Democrat and he's really hurting our party, or that guy's a Republican and he's really hurting our party. So I'll do it for people who are no longer in office. For the same reason, I won't comment on anyone who is involved in litigation until the trial and the appeals are over.
I guess these are ethical questions. You know, truth, democracy.
They really are. Jefferson had some very interesting things to say about the complex position that a leader is in a democracy, because democracy doesn't work without an informed public. But if you tell the truth to the public, then you're also telling the truth to your enemies who are watching and listening to everything you say. So I do discuss these things, these ethical issues, in the book Telling Lies with a lot of historical examples. There's not an easy answer when it comes to public responsibility for a publicly supported scientist. Even though I'm no longer supported by the public, everything I know and have learned was at the public expense.
Okay. Well, all right. We're almost at the point we have to finish. One of the questions I want to ask you, Dr. Ekman, given the fact that you have been doing this research for such a long time and thinking about this, I wonder, in your everyday interactions with people, is this something that you can turn off, or
No. Are
you all, so you can't. So every time you deal with someone, you've got your lie detector on, and sounds like you're detecting deceit all the time, and you cannot help but do that.
That's true, but you know, with friends and family, I never comment on what I see, because if I did, it would become a barrier. And they have come. My daughter, for example, believes I can never tell when she's lying. That's not true. I can, but I don't call her on it because I'm not a policeman. I'm a father.
Well,
that's a different role.
It also makes one wonder whether people, when they meet you, if they know who you are, I would think that many people might be made very uncomfortable by the very fact that they would in their interaction with you, they'd be thinking, now this guy, he's looking at me and he knows whether I'm telling him the truth or not.
Well, I always tell people to try to reassure them that I can read your mind, that the thoughts you have are totally concealed. I can only read your emotions and I can only infer whether you're being truthful, but what you're actually thinking, that I'll never know.
Well, the work that you've done, Professor Ekman, is very interesting, and I would expect that some of the people listening to us would be liking to read more on the subject. So
I guess, just mention one more thing.
Yes, please do.
I've co-authored a book with the Dalai Lama called Emotional Awareness. The paper that was published in the fall of 2008 and sort of got buried by the election and the recession. But the paperback edition comes out the end of this month, and I hope you'll have me back to talk about that topic. It's a very different topic. It's how do we become more aware of the emotions we feel as we feel it, and how do we develop a more compassionate attitude towards strangers.
Oh, we'd be happy to do that. Well, let's say sometime in the months ahead, maybe in the summer.
That would be great.
We'll do that. And in the meantime, anyone interested in the subject of detecting deceit, you might want to take a look at the book Telling Lies, Clues to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics, and Marriage, published by W.W. Norton. It's now in its fourth edition and paperback by our guest, Paul Ekman. He also has an interesting website you can look at. And if you're looking for his name, it is spelled EKMAN, Paul Ekman. He is emeritus professor at University of California, San Francisco. And Professor Ekman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. You're a great interviewer.
Very kind. The broadcast today is funded in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. In the next hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the Supreme Court and about some ideas that have been put forth by a group of law professors, mostly, on changing the structure of the court. And one of the main things is something that is very much like term limits for justices. In the next hour, we'll be talking with Paul Carrington. He's professor of law at Duke University. First, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and news. So please stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. There are definitely positive gains across the trading floor in Kansas City and Chicago, although we note that corn and bean prices have come back off of their highs on the day made earlier. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat now trading at 599 and a quarter, up 16 and a quarter. July 609 and a quarter, up 15 and a half. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 554 and a half, up 24 and a half. July, 567, up 24 and a half. May corn, 395, up 6 3/4. It's been as high as 402 and a half today. July, 405 and 3/4, up 7 1/4. December, 427 and a quarter, up 8 and a half. It reached a high on the day at